Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Christians in the Middle East, presented by Nellie Van Dorn Harder. The number is BAN 2006-02. Let's listen in.
They were the first ones to notice in the 1970s that Muslims suddenly, instead of talking to their Christian neighbors, doing things together, like breaking the fast in Ramadan together, celebrating the Christmas with the Christians, suddenly there was a change of heart, a change in attitude. And how did that come about? By the teachings of extremist Muslims who were trained in Saudi Arabia and then sent out first to all the Muslim countries to battle all the enemies of humanity, such as secularism, feminism, Christianity, and of course Zionism. That was one of the biggest enemies, or still is. And so somehow there was a change in the culture of living together, in the culture of accepting each other. And we were talking about that a little bit last night, but we learned from peace studies you have to give the other a face to talk to each other, but you can also deface the other. You can start to say so many evil things about the other that the other no longer is seen as human. That is what started in the Middle East. And people like me noticed that. You would come, I was a student in the 80s, I would come to Cairo and I would see these weird pamphlets on the street about Jesus having sex, and about that he had kids, and about the Trinity, and extremely insulting, extremely painful language was used there to show that Christians are on the wrong track. That was the message. That was the underlying message. These Christians among us are on the wrong track. Now, if you think about Christians in the Middle East, remember last night, the Middle East was Christian. Most people were Christian when Islam came in. And in the beginning, nobody realized these were people of another religion. They thought it was another Christian sect. They thought that for quite a while, till the Muslims started to draw those lines in the sand and say, nope, we have our own religion. They borrowed a lot from Christianity, but it became Islamic. And the whole Christian heritage was just, deleted, more or less, faded out. And only now some Muslims are starting to research that, like where are actually the influences, mainly from Judaism. The whole law system in Islam was informed by Jewish law, by the Jewish law system. The whole mystical system was informed, a great part of the mystical system was informed by Christian mysticism and by the Christian notion of love, of getting in touch with God personally, having your own personal relationship with Jesus, which then in Islam became having your own personal relationship with the Prophet Muhammad. So those things, there was a big, big mixing of cultures and societies going on in those first centuries of Islam. To remind those who forgot this, I'm talking about the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th century of the Christian era. Then, slowly Christians converted to Islam. This was not really only done by violence, it was demographic. Because when a Muslim man marries a Christian woman, the children are automatically Muslim, and conversion is forbidden in Islam. Remember the case in Afghanistan just a few months ago? Conversion is forbidden in Islam by penalty of death. And even if your government, such as in Egypt, no longer applies that penalty, your family will kill you. And I know that for a fact because I used to work as in a refugee agency in Egypt, and my most difficult cases were people who were beaten half dead by the family because they wanted to convert. And they had to, the only way out was to smuggle them out of the country. There was no other way. And so I became, what we heard last night, among the big liars of the teachers, because you had to lie. There was no other way. You had to get them out. Anyway, so slowly the Middle East became from mostly Christian Muslim. And by the Middle Ages, we're talking about the 11th century, it was half-half. And then the scale tipped. Then the scale tipped. And in the very beginning, in some countries, there were riots and there were some revolutions against the Muslims, but those were put down, and somehow the Muslims managed to keep hold of the power, because that's how they invaded those countries, saying, we rule you, you accept our rule, and we leave you alone. You can practice your own religion, but you are now in the position of a subject of Muslims, and you can only be Christian or Jewish, and you have special rules to follow. First rule, you cannot no longer practice any missionary activities. You cannot try to convert any Muslim. Second, you are not allowed to build churches without permission of the Muslim government. And that is still the rule in many countries in the Islamic world. And thirdly, you are not allowed to be part of the army. And fourthly, you have to be under, you can never rule over Muslims. The Muslim country can never have a Christian ruler. That is, for example, the problem in Nigeria, where we have a Christian president. And since we have a Christian president, the call for the application of Islamic law has grown and grown. And the underlying reason is we cannot be ruled by a Christian. So that is how, you know, so you are a secondary citizen. And these rules were official till the 19th century. They have been deleted now, but they are still in the mindset of most Muslims. Most Muslims, forgive me if I say it, consider us secondary. Only secularized Muslims or Muslims who have lived here for a long time and basically are secularized and Americanized will think differently, or Muslims who work closely together with Christians. But if you have, if you do not have that situation, they will not consider us fool. We are really in the same, men are on the same level as women, women and men are on the same level as children. That is the kind of law we fall into. Now, this is what Christians have lived with for, give or take a few years, 1400 years in the Middle East. And they have become minorities. From majority, they have become minority. And in Palestine, 1.8% of the population is Christian. And today I'm going to talk a lot about Egypt. There it's about between 7 and 9%. Nobody knows exactly that is still Christian. And these Christians feel that they have a very special call, a very call for witness. So that is why I came up with this topic when I heard that the theme for this year is I will always be with you. Because this is how these what these Christians live with. It's a living reality with them. If they do not feel daily God's always with us, then, you know, the next step to become Muslim is very easy. So it means it's not God that's always with us, especially Christ. Christ. Very strong relationship with Christ and St. Mary and so forth is what really colors Christianity, in many of the forms of Christianity in the Middle East. Now, what kind of Christianity am I talking about? This is the book that you might have seen. This is by Munib Younan, our bishop in Palestine, the Lutheran bishop in Palestine. He calls it Witnessing for Peace. It was written around the year 2000, and it just came out. And he writes, for example, that his mother was Greek Orthodox. Most Christians in the Middle East come from the Orthodox Church, and that these churches are very ancient, because Greek Orthodox is still relatively new, right? It was when Rome and the Western Orthodox Church broke in the 11th century that the Greek Orthodox Church was formed. But the churches in the Middle East, they come all, they have evolved as Orthodox churches, and only in, let's say, the 19th, 20th century, people were converted to Protestant or Catholic churches. And the Protestant churches, you know, they gave something that the Orthodox churches didn't provide, like the singing, the having your own responsibility, not having to go to confession. But what you see a lot is that Protestants will go to the Protestant church in the morning and to the Orthodox church in the evening. Or they will go to the Orthodox church in the morning, take communion there, and go to the singing activities of the Protestants in the evening. So you see, what you see is that people mix a lot. They belong to one, and Bishop Younan's mother was Greek Orthodox. So you see a lot of mixing in the Middle East, because it goes back to these ancient roots. And that's why I brought some pictures for you today. I thought you might like to have some visual aids there to think about what am I talking about. Now, Bishop Younan writes here, As a Palestinian Christian who was born and raised in the Christian quarter of the Old City, by which he of course means Jerusalem, my family's home was a mere 2 minutes away from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and 5 minutes from the Al-Aqsa Mosque of the Muslims and the Wailing Wall of the Jews. I have always felt that those Christians who lived within Jerusalem had a special responsibility to carry the living torch of faith that is handed to us by the apostles and the early church. These Christians come from the earliest church. The Christians in Egypt, for example, believe that their church was set up by St. Mark, the evangelist who came to Egypt between the year 40 and 70. So they go back a very long time. And they feel that now their witness is very, very special because they now have to keep the word of Christ alive as a minority. And again, when the extremists came in the 70s, it was not just changing the mindset that went on, it were also a lot of physical attacks. That is when you start to read the news about pharmacies of Christians being burned, churches being attacked, mobs of Muslims suddenly attacking a group of Christians celebrating a feast, and so forth and so forth. I don't know, it hardly reaches the news here. Have you heard anything, let's say, over the last year about Egypt or about any strife between Muslims and Christians? Who has heard something? Well, when I was in Egypt last semester, in the fall semester, in Alexandria, there was a big riot. And a nun was attacked and a deacon was attacked. And they both barely survived. They were attacked. And then Muslims started to storm the churches. And the police had to, send its troops. And several people died. And in the meantime, all the shops and cars and everything that was belonged to Christians were burned. This happened in Alexandria, in the center of Alexandria in October. Then, just a few months ago, someone attacked Christians just praying in their church with knives. And he killed several, and at the same time, several similar attacks were done in other churches, and the police in Egypt maintained this was a madman. But madmen don't have cars waiting for them to escape. So every time you look around, something is happening. You hear it so often, especially when you're there, small and big, when it's local, in villages. The year 2000 started with a mass murder in a village in the south of Egypt, where the majority was Christian. And the incident started with a quarrel between a shop owner and a Christian client. The shop owner was Christian and the client was Muslim. And in the end, over 100 people had died, and that's how the year. Welcome to the 21st century. So you see, you always have to look over your shoulder. You're never sure. And especially now with this extremism that has come over those countries. And so that is also what Bishop Yunnan is addressing, because what is happening is that people leave. You have the largest Assyrian Christian community, which comes from Iraq, is in Chicago. They're no longer in Iraq. Everybody's leaving. Copts are leaving. There are now Coptic churches, the Copts of Egypt. I didn't introduce that to you yet. The Copts of Egypt are the Christians of Egypt, the indigenous Christians, but all are called Copts. Coptic Protestants, Coptic Catholics, and Coptic Orthodox. And the largest church is Orthodox. They're all leaving. Then the largest Coptic Orthodox church is now in the States. New Jersey, Los Angeles, Chicago, huge Coptic Orthodox communities. But a handful stays and feels this special call to hold the word, to keep the word. And he said, and he writes, Jesus never answered fanaticism with fanaticism. And that is really what marks Christians in the Middle East. They are extremely peace-minded. Copts in Egypt will never attack back, because they know once you start to attack back, that is the beginning of the end. And that's what we've seen what happened in Egypt and in Indonesia. Muslim extremists attacked, Christians formed their own gangs and armies, attacked back, and in the end there were far more dead than would have happened if they would have not, you know, retaliated. So they never retaliate. So they really stress the message of peace. And they take, of course, they take this from Jesus' message, and they rely on the New Testament. So, for example, Jesus never said to the Pharisees, oh, you are fanatics, I'm not interested in you. For the woman who was taken in adultery, he wrote on the ground. He did not attack them directly. In Matthew 23, see how he replies with woe to those who are exclusivistic. When the Syrophoenician woman said, see the crumbs, he said, no, madam, you don't need to eat crumbs, eat bread. Similarly, he offers living water to the Samaritan woman. So they draw from the strangers who Jesus addressed and who were despised by the Pharisees and by the Orthodox Jews. Those, to them, are the model. And those, and they engage with them, and for them the most important issue is to keep the faith alive. Now, before I show you the pictures, you're of course wondering where are these pictures now. before I show them to you, I want to say one more thing. Being a Christian in the Middle East also very much influences your political stand. For example, all Palestinian Christians engage in the same struggle as the Muslims against Israel. They want, you know, Israel to give them land and to leave them alone and so forth and so forth. The problem is, of course, the suicide bombers. What do you do with them? Right? Now, in a way, you can say, thank, praise the Lord, it's now still, the enemy is, there's still a clear enemy, it's Israel. So everybody fights against Israel. And I must say, we Sunday we had a special collection, remember, and part of it was for Palestine. They have very strong ministries, the Palestinian Christians, with hospitals, schools, and so forth, that are now booming, especially now the Hamas government was elected in Palestine, the more extremist-minded government. The Christian facilities are booming because Hamas is not getting money, but the Christians are still getting their supplies. So they have a very specific attitude and towards the politics of the world. And of course, similarly to the Copts in Egypt, they are all against the invasion in Iraq. Because they do not see that as a liberation, they see that as an invasion of a foreign power in their land. In their land. And they do not see that in terms of Christian Muslim. They are against it, and they have spoken out against it. Now, for example, Christians in Egypt, they are not allowed to go on pilgrimage in Jerusalem because their Pope, decided that as long as there is no solution for the Holy Land, or no solution for peace between Palestine and Israel, Christians from Egypt will not go on pilgrimage to Israel. And if you do, guess what? You're excommunicated. And for real. Because Orthodox churches have their power. So let me now show you the pictures. Now, does it bother you if I stand there? Or should we ask someone to go from picture to picture for us? Yeah? You can, where the cursor is. Does that bother you, think? Oh, no, or maybe just this one.
Just push the arrow.
This one? Oh, no, the enter. Yeah, the enter button. You see the enter button? You see? Just the enter button. Yeah, there we go. So you see the promise. They are living the promise, I will always be with you. Yeah, the next one. Now, first of all, what really, as you heard just now from the words of Bishop Yunnan, Christians in the Middle East feel very closely connected to the Holy Family. You know, Jesus was born in Palestine, and many places that he walked and where he was active are in current Palestine. But then he had to flee to Egypt, which gives the Egyptians a very strong connection to the Holy Family. And they honor the Holy Family. They actually have an itinerary. They know exactly where the Holy Family was, where the baby Jesus was washed, and where they slept, and oh yeah, they know everything. And how do you know this? You have any idea?
Yeah, it was
that was in Palestine. Helena?
Helen, Queen Helena, who retraced the steps and found the cross, of course. Yeah, but it was also, actually, when did the Egyptians discover the itinerary? That was not before the 12th century. By a dream. By a dream. But the patriarch was going to bless a new monastery in the south of Egypt, and he had a dream of Virgin Mary, who said, hey, you better show a little bit respect, because that was the last place where my blessed son and the rest of the family stayed. And then he had the presence of mind in his dream to ask, okay, where else did you stay? And so he made a whole itinerary which starts in the north of Egypt. I should have shown you a map of Egypt. I'm sorry, I didn't bring that. But it's not, if you can imagine, in Egypt you have Sinai, and then you cross, and there is Egypt. Mm-hmm. You see, you go, so here is the Holy Land, Sinai, Egypt. So they came in the north of Egypt, and so you find monasteries, holy places, all over Egypt, exactly following the itinerary. And this place is made in a grotto, in a rock. And you see the scene is how do you say that in English? Hewn out? How do you say that?
Hewn,
is the word, okay. Hewn out of the rock, and then, you know, and in the rock they made a church, and the whole church is decorated like this, with scenes of the flight to Egypt.
Where in Egypt is that?
This is in Cairo. This is in Cairo, and it is in a place, and we'll see more pictures of this place called Mokattam, which was one of the poorest areas in Egypt, because Copts, the Christians, belong to all layers of society. They can be very rich, they can also be very poor. So they mix in with the population. They stand out because their birth rates are less, and because they very much value education for their children. But there are many, many poor Christians who work as farmers, and one of the most prominent jobs of the Christians is garbage collecting. Why? Because garbage collecting is considered something that makes a Muslim impure. So the Christians do the impure work, and what they also then do on the side is raise pigs. They have pig farms. And that, you know, from the meat they produce ham that you can buy in certain Christian shops, all that is completely unclean. Now, this whole project, we're now in that area where the garbage collectors live, in the 80s a church was built, and now there are 5 churches, and these churches were very lavishly decorated on the inside. And this is also, again, this is a new idea of, and I'll show you some other pictures how the classical decoration is among the Copts. But this is a new idea to show the flight to Egypt. But also, again, this whole project is based on a dream. From a man who was an engineer who wanted to become a pastor, and who suddenly had this inspiration, and then a dream to confirm it, and then he found a part of the New Testament that gave him a lesson that also confirms it, saying like, I forgot where it's from, outside the cities are many living, something like that. I'm not even sure where it's from, maybe Anne of Uruk recognizes it, but he felt, I have to go there, so he moved into the area, started to clean it up, started to raise funds, and now, and started of course also service projects for the poor garbage collectors. Okay, so the main point is here as well, very strong connection with the Holy Family, very strong connection with Jesus and with St. Mary. Yeah, we can see the next one. Now, St. Mary has been portrayed and the flight to Egypt since the earliest days of Christianity. This is an icon which they think is from the 10th or 11th century. They're not quite sure. And this is found in one of the oldest monasteries that dates from the 8th century. I just thought it's fun to see, right? Mm-hmm. And this kind of reproductions you find everywhere in the form of posters. And again, people hang those in their house and really also develop a strong relationship with the Holy Family. Yeah.
Who's that figure in the back in the red?
Oh, I'm not sure I have to go back here, but the figure in the back in the red is Salome. Salome, who according to the apocryphal, some apocryphal gospels mention her, according to the tradition, she was the midwife. She was the midwife and she came with to Egypt. Yeah. Now this is the way, again, this is an old way, it's a fresco from the monastery of St. Anthony. And this fresco you will find in the altar. In the altar. So it shows that where the altar, where the holiest of holies is, where people take their communion and the cups take communion very seriously, looking down on them is a picture of Jesus most of the time and a picture of Jesus and Mary. Yeah. Well, the thing is, this is very interesting, by the way, a sideline. Here you can see the influence of the Islamic environment. You no longer paint real-life people because you're not allowed to do that. Remember the picture war in Denmark? Mm-hmm. Right. You're not allowed to. Originally, you're not allowed to make pictures of people. So they make impressions, symbolic pictures or representations of the saints and so forth. Okay, now, and this, I want to show you this, because this is a very new picture of Mary, and I found it in a remote church in the south, because you see she's much more lifelike. Now, what does this represent? It represents the I will always be with you theme, because the Virgin Mary regularly appears in Egypt. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. Yes. 68 and 86 were the 2 years, 68, just after the war with Israel, where the Arabic armies were all, you remember, the five, was it the 5 day war?
Six day war.
See, I knew it was wrong, five. 6 day war. The 6 day war, and the whole nation fell defeated, not just Muslims, the whole nation fell defeated, and they now feel St. Mary came to us to console everybody. And the strange thing is, I cannot process this in my mind. She was visible on top of a church for months. And people would gather around that church. And the strange thing is, we don't hear of that, right? People would gather around the church and many, many miracles took place. There are packs of books with verified miracles, with, you know, x-ray, someone had this tumor and now it's gone. This person was blind since birth and now can see. And also many Muslims were healed. However, just after that, this extremist wave started. It's so strange, right? If you have had this experience, I mean, wouldn't we change our mind if we had miracles like that?
But there were even pictures of it. Huh? There were pictures of it.
Yes, there are pictures. There are pictures. Now, this is the new iconography by some people who had seen her and then, you know, became inspired to make a picture of her and put that in a church. So that's why I wanted to show you. This is much more modern. Yeah?
Is that incense on the side?
What?
Incense on the side?
That portrays incense of you know, the prayers of the people going up to heaven and being heard by the intercessor of the Virgin Mary. Yeah.
What's the symbol of the white dress? Is that a bride or
purity?
Purity. Yeah. Okay. Well, I thought you need a picture of St. Mark. The one on the right. And the cups can tell you all the predecessors of the current patriarch, and it starts with St. Mark. And as you see, then the pictures become more lifelike. And you have a whole gallery of all the patriarchs, till the one we have now, and that's the next picture. This is, oh, I'm so bad. The microphone is on his nose. This is the current patriarch of the Coptic Orthodox Church. The Orthodox churches have their local churches, they have their own patriarchs. And so he rules over the Copts in Egypt and the Copts in America and the Netherlands and so forth and so forth. And he is now 81, if I'm not mistaken. He started out as a journalist and an English teacher. And he is one of the architects of an enormous revival of the Coptic Orthodox Church. Because that is, again, I will always be with you, the strange thing that happened in the Church of Egypt was that by the 1920s, missionaries from the States and England had large conferences deciding what to do when the Coptic Church would all have become Protestant, and deciding also what to do when all the Muslims would have become Protestant. Well, they didn't. They could postpone those decisions. It didn't happen. But what happened was that the Coptic Church was really asleep. Over the course of the centuries, the Copts had taken, Muslims had taken, of course, the practices of the Copts, and I'll show you some practices in a little bit. Copts took Muslim practices, like marrying more than one wife. That was a very, very obvious practice. The patriarch couldn't say anything against that. He couldn't do anything. The Coptic hierarchy, the rich people, the gentry of the Copts, they exactly copied the Muslims. And also what you had is that the Coptic Church rests on monastic life. It rests on the monasteries. And this is not just Coptic Church, this is actually all Orthodox churches. The source is the monasteries. That's where you get your bishops from, that's where you get your patriarch from, and those are unmarried. Pastors are married, they have to be married, because they have to know the family life. But the hierarchy of the church is unmarried, and a lot of the theological works would be written in the monasteries. We had hundreds of monasteries in Egypt at the time of the invasion of Islam, and slowly they disappeared, were closed, because it became dangerous to be a monk. Monks were often attacked by roaming Bedouins, not necessarily because of the religion, just Bedouins searching for food and searching for supplies. So by the beginning of the 20th century, the core supply of the Coptic Church had kind of almost shriveled up, dried out. And there was no new life in the Coptic Church. Now, what did Copts do? Lay Copts were very smart. They looked at the Protestant model and took what they liked from it, which was mostly the Sunday schools. They took the Sunday school model and they started to train kids. Remember we talked yesterday about how important it was to teach kids? They started to teach kids in Sunday schools, and I'm not talking about half an hour a week. I'm talking about at least 10 hours a week or 20. And it starts at the age of 2 and it goes up all the way till university level. Because it's a very strict Sunday school package. And they retrain them. And then the predecessor of this man had the insight to go to these Sunday schools and handpick the most brilliant men and women and the most devout men and women and encourage them to devote and dedicate their life to the church. And that is how the monasteries became repopulated. And so when this man came to power, and he has power, actually he has great power, came to power in 71 over the Copts, he has lots of power. So that's 35 years ago, he found a church that was coming back. And that is also so interesting to realize that while we have these extremist attacks, this church is blossoming and booming, and the spiritual life is developing and becoming stronger and stronger. That's what we see in Egypt. And this, by focusing on the core of the Christian message, and by saying all of us have something of a monk in us, or a nun. What does a monk or a nun do for a living? They pray 8 hours a day, they work 8 hours a day, and if they are lucky, they sleep a bit. Right? And so they say, we can do that too, but we cannot completely practice that every day, the whole day, but we can take a bit of it. We can say, I take half an hour, I take a quarter of an hour, I'm going to focus on a prayer. I was asked to do the startup for the morning? The eye-opening tomorrow morning, and I was going to do that together. That praying, okay, if you're very busy, you can always take, for example, one line from the Bible, just one line or one verse, and keep that in your mind all day. Do not go out of your house empty. Yeah. So, and then also the prayer life of the Orthodox Church is 7 times a day. Who has time for that? The monks have, the nuns have, and so they pray on behalf of all of us, and we do what we can. You see. And so if you can do all the prayers 7 times a day, stop for a moment and pray. Refresh your mind. That's what they say. So he has, for 35 years, watched over an enormously developing church where that did not gain new converts because it cannot convert people around it, remember? It did not gain new members, but the members it had became totally re-inspired. Okay, let's look at the next one. Now, what I like about the Copts is how practical they are in all this. They you know, you say all these monks and all these nuns and these bishops and these parents, they pray and pray and pray. They are so practical, and I love this one. They have been thinking about it. Okay, Jesus was baptized, didn't he need a towel? Where did this towel come from? Angels, of course, because such a holy person cannot be given a towel just by John the Baptist. So here we have the baptism of Jesus. This is a wall painting made, a new modern wall painting in one of the monasteries near Cairo. And you see God's hand and the dove coming out, and then these angels ready with the towel. So that is what the Copts think about every detail in the Bible and try to apply it to real life. And the next one, for example, who has ever really seen icons of the 24 elders from the apocalypse? Whoever cares about them? Do we ever wake up and think, I must really study those elders? The Copts make icons from them. And this icon is from a hyper-modern church in the north of Cairo that was still under construction. So this was just sitting against the wall and was going to be put up in the altar. Because these are our models. These people, they made it. They made it into heaven, right? These are our models. So when we take communion, we better also remember our models. These were regular, normal people. And look at them now. Wearing crowns, white robes, having the incense. You see, the incense is very important. Bringing the chants and the praises of the people to God. And always praising God. Unfortunately, they're all men, but that's a little bit, yeah, I know. I'm not sure if they can be explained as only man in the Bible. But that is something that we struggle with. It is, if we come back to the culture again, it's a very patriarchal church. Very patriarchal. It is Muslim and Christian women have very much in common in the way they are treated. They are considered as secondary to their husband. And the only thing that is a plus for Christian women is that divorce in Islam is much easier. And divorce really can bring you up a path to enormous poverty in the Middle East. So they really have the guarantee that the marriage will last. So because you're not allowed to divorce, which is another problem again. There's a list of 10 reasons to divorce, and one of them is that if the husband disappears for 5 years, if one of the two gets mad, you know, things like that. Really, really extreme circumstance. Another reason for divorce is if one of the two becomes a Muslim. And that's what a lot of people have done. They become Muslim to get a divorce and then want to go back and then it's not possible. So then they become Presbyterian or something, you know?
What yeah. did they have on their thumbs? There was just one that didn't have anything on the thumb. They're like a worm.
What?
What's on
the thumb? On the hand. There's a little worm on the hand.
Maybe it's the thing that holds the incense.
Yeah, it's the incense. It's the incense.
The sensors.
They hold it. As I say, they are very particular. They think about every detail. And also, this is another thing, talking about gender again. Because like last night, I was talking about female circumcision. The Copts practices as much as the Muslims. You know, this is some again the culture, and Coptic women that they need the permission of their husband to take a job and things like that, and in the marriage vows it is very clearly said that the man is the head of the family and that the woman has to obey what he wants. Now the senders. Now I realize why it's only men, these elders. Women are no longer allowed to hold senders. And that brings us to the next picture, which I had put in also, again, for the gender aspect. Women, because censers are part of the official liturgy. The official liturgy of the church is only done by men. Women are not allowed anything. No reading of the Bible. Of course, forget about, serving over the word and sacrament. And not even singing. There is not really, in a Coptic church, there's not really singing hymns. There is chanting done by deacons. Deacons will chant the liturgy, and women can say Amen. Or Kyrieleison. That is the only thing, Kyrieleison, Kyrieleison. That is the only song that women can join in. Now, let's get back for 1 minute. What is very interesting, again, St. Mary is everywhere in the altar, right? Now, this is again from the same church that I showed you the first picture of the flight to Egypt, the second picture where they were on the donkey with Salome. This church has three altars, and in each altar you find in the top a picture of the Virgin Mary. And you see there's no Arabic there, you see? It's still in an ancient script. And you see that she is holding the baby Jesus with angel next to her. And around her are the angels. Now, what you also have in this church is several scenes of the Dormition. You know, the Copts believe that the Virgin Mary didn't die, but was taken up to Egypt, to heaven. And in August, which is the date again that you celebrate that? Which is the date of St. Mary again? 11th of August or something? You celebrate that in August, that she was taken up to heaven. Now that scene you find a lot, but I can't show it to you because I don't have a picture of it, and because it needed a special camera. Now, what was the biggest blow to male pride in Egypt this last year? This church is being cleaned up. This scene was found after having been covered for, let's say, 1,000 years. And it was a team of international and Egyptian experts cleaned it up and found different frescoes and found actually layers of frescoes. So they're taking apart these layers and suddenly you have 5-6 layers of representations. What did they find? They found a scene of the Dormition, you call it, when the Virgin Mary is taken up to heaven, where she is surrounded by women holding censers. Oh my land! The patriarch had to be phoned. And the monks immediately said, "These are not women. It must be men." Oh. No. The art historian said, "These are definitely women. Look, they're wearing a head cover. This cannot be. This is wrong. This was a heretical painter." And so the art historian started to do research and found out that at the time that picture was made, the censer was not yet part of the liturgy. So women could swing them around as much as they wanted. and it showed that women had a much more important place in the liturgy if they were allowed to hold censers. You see? So slowly, very slowly, the feminism is creeping in, even in the Middle East. But again, you always have to be careful with your environment. You cannot go too far, because then you will get reactions from the Muslim neighbors, and they will maybe use it against you. So you have to be very careful what you do. Okay, the next one. So you see, there is deeply grained ideas that you find throughout the Middle East, whether people are Christian or Muslim. This is just a monk, and I like him very much. I took the picture because this is the patriarch I was talking about. I didn't actually give you the name of the patriarch we show. Shenouda the Third. He is the one who's the patriarch now. This is Kyrillos the Sixth, and he was an amazing man. He was a statesman. He had this vision and insight of putting different movements together and shape them into one, force. And he saw young people do this and old people do that and churches do this and American Copts do that. And he was the one who then reshaped a lot of the Coptic life, and he was the foundation of the current revival. And this is one of his deacons, who is the only deacon who's still alive, Abuna Raphael, Father Raphael. And Father Raphael has now as his life calling to gain all the stories that people experience through the intercession of this man. His grave is close to Alexandria, but the latest story was that he saved the Protestant husband of a Coptic woman living in the States, and the husband was on duty in Iraq. Yes, through his, according to the story, through his miraculous intervention, the man was not killed, but survived, and he was in a truck, and through a vision by the patriarch, he said, stop that truck, and the man stopped the truck, and then found out that there was a mine on the road. A land, and so and could then go around it, and the whole truck with the man was saved. So Abuna Raphael, Father Raphael, he saves all, he gathers all these stories and puts them in books, and those books are in English, French, German, every language you can think of. So there, and so they go around the world. So in a way, this message goes around the world. There are people, you know, Copts believe there are people praying on our behalf in heaven, and if we believe in them. And we ask them, hey, Kyrillos, think about me once in a while. He will. He will pray for us. And that's what they, that is their strong message. We are never alone. The host of heaven is with us. And we are on earth, but in heaven is the other earth. And we are connected all the time. We are never alone in this. You see? And that is another saint, and I hate that picture on the right. I think that's a very ugly way of Saint Menas, who was a healer, and close to where Saint Menas is buried, the grave of Kyrillos can be found. Okay, well, there are some women active in the church, and I can't go into that. But these are some active nuns. They are again. This is a model taken from. The Catholic Church, because Orthodox churches normally don't have active nuns. Nuns, and I'm looking for a picture, because you are actually not allowed to take pictures from contemplative monks. I have one picture in here, which I took illegally. I didn't have that on my computer, so I couldn't bring it on there. But it will come. When I keep looking, I'll find it. But anyway, so that is part of this revival. Allow women options apart from being a contemplative. You know, a contemplative nun sits in the monastery, is not allowed out. It's like behind bars. This is what a contemplative nun looks like. And these active nuns, they have set up, these are the ones who are in charge of making altar curtains. But they have set up projects all over Egypt. All kinds of social projects, of economic projects, educational projects, and their projects are so well known that now churches from Greece come and study them, how to do this in the Orthodox Church. And also they have become so influential in the community, in the country or in the society that, and again, this is again patriarchal, the boss of the community was a bishop. He won a huge national award for the work they do and for the development work they do. And so we do have women. And so these women, you know, they spread out all over Egypt. They come to the stage to learn, for example, what they did, start handicap projects for handicap. Is it time? Oh, dear. Let's quickly go on. And if you want, I can speak more about the Copts another time. Now this is another place where the Holy Family stayed from the 6th century, and it is of course renovated. And this is a nunnery where these women in black sit behind bars. Yeah? And this is what they built near Alexandria, where they made a huge agricultural project where they raise olive trees and things that they sell. So you see, although they're behind bars, that's a myth, that's becoming a myth too. They go out and set down a huge farm like this, and which has also become a real retreat center for people to come and renew their spirit for a day. Yeah. Now, I just want to show you some graffiti. 1626, someone felt compelled to write on a church, the Church of the St. Anthony Monastery, in the desert that is close to Sinai. And this person wrote that he was there, 1626. But it also shows you how long these places have been known, and that they were visited by people from outside. And this is across every time something special happened, people would dedicate a cross on the wall of the church. And so this church is filled with crosses. So you know, oh, big things must have happened. You know, this was not minor things, but when something big happened, because you had to be rich to somehow hire an artist to do this. And so I just thought you might like to see that. And I like the cross. Now this is one of the latest developments in this whole revival. There's a huge retreat center built close to Cairo, and guess who retreats there all the time? Danes, Finns, Norwegians, Swedes, people from the most de-church countries, they come there. And somehow, if this is flying through Europe, and they go there, and they have their retreats. And it is Coptic monks and nuns and lay people talking to them. And part of it is art. This is all love. They have to do art, and they can make icons if they want. They can make anything they want. And this is one of the churches. And the idea of how to shape the buildings for the architecture came from the people themselves. And again, with very simple materials, like a hole in the village in the middle of Egypt. The material had to come from the land, had to be locally, the building had to be done by the people themselves, and here they have this fantastically beautiful church. This I love, I want to show you this. This is the wall of mirrors. This is a mirror, and you see it's broken. And they made a hall of mirrors, and that you go through to meditate, and they said the ideas from Taizé. You go and you look in the mirror, you look at yourself, so you see yourself, and you see your sins, and you see everything you've done wrong. And you also see others in the mirror, so you think about others. And then you have mirrors that enlarge, mirrors that make you smaller, mirrors that are broken. What do you do when your life breaks? You put it together, and you can still make something beautiful of it, out of it. That's the message of this mirror. You put it back and you make an artwork of the broken mirror. There's never till you die, it's never too late. So that is the Hall of Mirrors, and I thought you might be interested in seeing that. Do we know anything like that in here? For example, there's 1.3 mirrors. I mean in the States, not just here, but there's three mirrors that, you know, well, you always have to think about, okay, I'm a couple. For example, you have your parents, and the third is your child. Or you are a couple and the third is your aunt or uncle or mother or father. What's your relationship? How do you treat them? You know, so they want you to think about your life by going through the mirrors. And this is going back to the first place where I said the garbage collectors lived. This man used to be a garbage collector, and he said he also was an alcoholic because his life was so hopeless. And then this project started, and he now speaks English. He has finished high school, and he is a guide in those churches. Mm. And he said, it was really the message of the church that saved me. And this person next to him, she's an Armenian Christian. Mm-hmm. So she was with us. And this, do I need to say more about the garbage? No. This is the streets of the garbage collectors' villages. But you see the cross on the wall there, in the house. And there do you see this kind of boat hanging there with a picture of St. Mary, another picture of St. Mary, and a picture of St. Manus in the middle. Oh. That is the product of a feast, a festivity. You have these feasts for the saints, and then people hang these kind of boats that they make themselves, and then they leave them all here to remind themselves of the saints. And here again you see Jesus. It's not a very clear picture. I don't have a very fantastic camera. But you see all that, you drive through these piles of dirt and you see all these pictures of Jesus on the Christian houses. So like, you know, Jesus is victorious and we will win. And again, it's mostly posters because people are still not that rich that they can afford more. And I wanted to show you some of the kids, but these now go to school. So that is another, and that's a part, again, going to school, going to Sunday school, learning what the Christian faith is about, and then become an actor yourself. That is the idea. Is it?
Yeah.
It's our